Hello everyone and welcome back to episode 31 of season 1 Reading with Grace, where we will continue reading The Unwanted's Island of Fire. Today we will be picking up from chapter 36, but first a quick recap of chapters 31 through 35. Alex was able to remove Megan's thorns from her neck with a new spell called Dissipate, very dangerous, but now she can talk again. Alex is having some feelings for Skye, but he can't seem to figure them out. Megan told all the lead advisors about her experience on Warbler, and for some reason, Skye and Crow are extremely nervous to remove their thorn necklaces. Alex found out it's because they believe if they take them off, Warbler birds will come to peck their eyes out. Alex was told his mother is about to have another set of twins. Alex convinced Skye to let him take off her thorn necklace, and when she spoke, he described it as the most beautiful sound he had ever heard. That's the end of the summary. Enjoy the episode! Lessons in Warblish. Every day, whenever Lonnie could find a moment when no one was watching, she sent out a seek spell. And every day, when no one came to rescue them, she lost a little more hope. She was assigned to work in a fire cave, melting gold coins and making thorn necklaces. There were 5 or 6 other workers there around Lonnie's age, and they showed her how to use a mold to form long, thin, sharply pointed strings of gold. While the strings were still hot, the workers loosely weaved several of them together in a curve shape, making sure the pointed ends were at the proper angles to easily be inserted into someone's neck. It was the most horrible job Lonnie could think of. The cave had a hole in the high ceiling which let in some natural light. It also let out the smoke from the fire. It was beastly hot in there and terribly sooty. The others talked now and then with gestures that Lonnie didn't understand. Most of the time, everyone plodded along, making gleaming golden thorns lost in their own thoughts. It was beyond frustrating. Lonnie wanted to scream, to tear the thorns from her neck and yell and stomp her feet and just hear something again besides the rare voice of an unthorned supervisor. She wanted the young women she worked with to be as angry as she was, but they weren't. They were complacent. Days passed. Lonnie went from the woman's bunkhouse to her job in the fire cave and back to the bunkhouse. Her leash kept her tied to the complicated wire system above her head as she slept, bathed, and worked. Whenever she walked from one place to another, she strained her eyes looking for any sign of Sam Heed, worried that he was still locked in the dark cave all alone. As much as she wanted to try and rip the wire off her with her bare hands, she knew there was nowhere to escape to, and she wasn't doing anything without Sam Heed. They were in this together, to the end. As she worked, an empty feeling made her chest ache, and tears burned her eyes. She couldn't get the image out of her head, the man shoving Sam Heed to the ground, and Sam lying there, not moving, as the hulking beast dragged her away from him. She couldn't stop thinking about him. What if, after all this, she'd never see him again? What if he was dead? She couldn't bear to think about it. At night, his name was on her lips as she tossed and turned on her cot. She clasped her hands together and held them to her cheek, eyes closed, pretending she was holding Sam Heed's hand, wishing with all her might that when she opened her eyes again, he would be there. But of course, he never was. It was on her second week outside the dark cave, after a long, hard day of work, that a woman summoned Lonnie and a blonde-haired girl who was also tethered to the wire. Lonnie didn't know the girl's name, and no one knew Lonnie's either. There was really no reason to learn anyone's name when you couldn't speak. The woman led them out to the main hallway into the small room with boulders for chairs. A few people sat there. As the girls entered, they were ushered to one side of the room. Lonnie looked around at all the others, and her heart jumped to her throat. There sat Sam Heed, also tethered to the ceiling wire on the purple line. His head was bowed. He hadn't seen her. Lonnie stared at him, willing him to look up. After a moment, he did. His eyes were vacant at first, but when he saw Lonnie, they filled with recognition and longing. Lonnie swallowed hard and tried to smile, but only the corner of her mouth quivered. Her heart fluttered. She really hadn't seen him since the day they'd been captured. They held one another's gaze, telling stories with their eyes, until a voice startled them from their private, silent conversation. "I am Wimbrow," a woman said. "Your behavior has earned you all the right to learn how to speak in our island's sign language." She wore no thorn necklace, but scars marked her neck when one had most certainly been. "The language is for communication only, when necessary, not for idle chatter. Anyone caught using the language excessively will be sent to the dark cave." The handful of tethered people in the room didn't react. The threat of the dark cave seemed to be the punishment for everything. In their handbooks and their instructions for their new jobs in the dining hall, there was nothing much worse than the dark cave, it was true, but they'd all survived it, apparently. In a few years, if you prove yourself loyal and worthy, Queen Agala will consider removing your neck device, as she obviously has done for me, Rimble said, her voice brimming with pride, but then her face grew dark. However, if you try to remove it yourself, you will suffer a terrible fate. All pairs of eyes in the room opened wider. This was news. The woman hunched over and said in a low, sinister voice, The birds of Warbler are spies for the queen. They can track you by your thorns. If anyone but the queen removes your necklace, swarms of Warbler birds will come after you, no matter where you are. She bent farther toward the group and whispered, And they will peck your eyes out. Lonnie glanced at Sam Heed just as he glanced at her, and they both had to look away quickly to keep a straight face. It was the most ridiculous thing they had ever heard in their lives, more ridiculous than any the High Priest Justina told them in Quill. Besides, it was obvious the queen gave them orange eyes so they could be identified and killed if they ever escaped. It seemed pretty silly that she'd send birds to peck them out after all that effort. What good would that do? But the sad part was, everyone else in the room seemed to believe it with all their heart, even the woman speaking. What kind of crazy place is this? Lonnie had asked herself over and over again. Fear, fear, and more fear. What is Warbler so afraid of that they had to silence everyone on it? Is every island this messed up? And if any strangers find their way onto our shores or into our caves, you must not address them. Immediately get help. Understood? The small group, including Lonnie and Sam Heed, nodded. Rimbrel seemed satisfied that she had instilled a sufficient amount of fear into their hearts and minds of the newest members of Warbler. She went on to teach them a dozen or so hand signals, words like come, go, help, inside, outside, eat, sleep, work, danger, please, and thank you. Lonnie almost laughed at the last two. At least the people of Warbler were polite. She shook her head and caught Sam Heed looking at her. She held his gaze for a moment, a feeling of warmth flooding her chest. What a relief it was to see him, actually see him. It felt like a part of her that had been missing was back again. She smiled and looked down, not wanting Wimbrel to suspect they knew each other. Once they learned their hand signals, Wimbrel said, Now pair up and practice the symbols with a partner. As the blonde girl turned toward Lonnie, Lonnie pretended not to notice and instead stood up and stepped over to Sam Heed. He half grinned in covert delight and moved over to the boulder chair. Lonnie hopped on and perched cross-legged, facing him, close enough to touch. Rimbro didn't seem to mind. She wasn't exactly the house mother type. As Wimbo called out each word, the language students took turns signing it to their partner. Soon the instructor told them to go ahead and work on their own. She sat down near the door, pulled a paper from her pocket, and began to study it. Lonnie's eyes flew open. She shifted so that Sam Heed's body mostly blocked her from Wimbo's sight. And then she reached for Sam Heed's hand and took it in hers. It was almost as if their blood pulsated together through their fingertips. Lonnie's body tingled and she took in a sharp breath. She looked up and saw Sam Heed swallow hard, his thorns wavering as he did so. And then he tapped gently into her hand in their own private language. I miss you like crazy. A ray of light. Lonnie held her breath, willing herself not to cry, because that would surely draw the attention of Wimbrel. I miss you too, she tapped back. I'm so glad you're okay. She studied him, his new golden orange eyes piercing hers. His dark hair was longer than it had ever been, and the ends curled up a bit around his ears and at his neck. They made a show of doing some of their signs in case anyone was looking. Sammy pointed to himself and then signed, Work outside. He pointed to her, a question burning in his eyes. Inside, Lonnie signed back. Go? She raised an eyebrow. Danger? Sam Heed pressed his lips into a line. He took her hand and tapped. I make ships, covered area so no one can see from water or sky. Lonnie glanced over his shoulder and signed randomly. Come, go, thank you, please. She tapped. I'm in the fire cave making metal thorns. He flashed her a look of pity and signed. Work, sleep, eat. She tapped again. We have to get out of here. And then she signed. Go, come, outside. He nodded and tapped. Stealing wood to make raft. Slow going. When do we get leashes off? Lonnie shrugged. She saw Rimbo fold her paper and put it back into her pocket. Lonnie began signing, flashing a warning with her eyes to Sam Heed before wiping her face of all emotion once again. Wimbrel stood and began walking around the room, looking at each pair and watching them sign, correcting them if they were not quite accurate. She paused at Sam Heed's side and watched as Lonnie signed beautifully. Danger, please, help. Good, Wimbrel said. She smiled primly at Lonnie and moved on. Tomorrow, we'll learn another set. Lonnie's lips parted in surprise. Tomorrow? She tapped into Sammy's hand. He grinned and his face flushed. Best news of the year, he tapped. And then he gave Lonnie's hand a little squeeze, and she squeezed back. It felt right to have their fingers entwined again. Thirty-eight. Making Plans. While Sean and Megan rode Simber to Warbler Island to study the terrain, Alex and Florence spent their time gathering information from Sky and Crow. Crow was now free of his thornman as well, and both of the silent children had a good deal of trouble getting their voices to work properly at first. After some practice and a little bit of magical help from Miss Morning, Crow's voice came back, though it still squeaked from time to time. He told Alex that he had his necklace on for only a few weeks before he and Sky escaped on the raft. Sky, on the other hand, had had her thornament attached to her for a few more years. Even with magic, her voice came back much more slowly and remained husky from that point on, which she didn't seem to mind. Alex thought she sounded quite nice indeed. After a while, they gathered in the hospital ward to talk so that Claire and Gunnar would listen from their beds. Alex and Florence asked them everything they could think of about Warbler. Soon, with Sky's hoarse directions, Alex was sketching a map of the underground tunnels and outlining the various workstations around the island, all hidden from the view of the shore and camouflaged with brush and trees. "Do you have any idea where Sam and Lonnie would be?" Alex asked as he studied his work. Sky leaned over the map, her hair falling forward. Absently, she tucked it behind her ear and pointed to the center of the maze of caves and tunnels. "They'd be in the dark cave for quite a while," she said, her voice a husky song. "That's where they put you after they administer the thorns and the acid eye drops. I think it needs to be fairly dark for the eyes to heal." She said it without a note of bitterness. Florence studied the girl with a curious look. "It's hard to say how long you're in there, though. It feels like a long time when you don't know when something's going to end," Sky mused. "It's pretty traumatic," she glanced at Crow. "Isn't it, buddy?" Crow nodded. He was almost as quiet as before he'd had his thorns removed. He tilted his head and reached across the map. "That's where the boys sleep. You get chained to a wire for a while before they knew you're good." From her bed, Claire wore a stony expression. She shook her head. "I'm so sorry," she said in a quiet voice. Sky pointed to a large cave on the opposite side. "The girls are in this one." She pointed to the various caves in clockwise pattern. "Here's where they manufacture clothing. I work there a part of the time, and also in the shipyard. This is the dining and kitchen area. Where is Crow worked? Mining is done in this cave here and throughout the island. There's an open mine hidden by rock overhangings in the center of Warbler, and there is also a waterfall with freshwater river flowing through the middle of the island. This big cave at the south end," she said, looking at Alex, "which is the opposite side from where Megan said she and the others anchored the boat. It is where the fire cave is. They make the thorns there by melting the gold. And over here," she said, pointing to the east side of the island, "is shipbuilding." "Ships," Alex said, tapping his lips and thinking. "Multiple ships?" "A fleet," Crow said. "Queen Ugala wants them for attack." Alex turned to Crow. "What attack?" Sky interrupted. "Let me tell this part, okay, Crow?" She smoothed his hair off his forehead. He shook his head to mess it back up again, but he looked amiable enough and was silent. Sky hopped up on a chair like she'd seen Alex do when he addressed a group. She hunched over, arms reaching out in front of her as if she were imagining a new setting, and began what sounded like a story. "Many years ago, Ugala was born on Warbler Island to the current ruling family. When she was a child, she and her older brothers and sisters created the sign language that Warbler now uses. Some of them could do magic. Today, Warbler Island is charmed with a magical silence spell created by Ugala herself. The queen and her siblings kept their magic a secret for years. One day, when she was still a young girl, Igala's oldest brother and sister left to explore the 6 other islands in our world, but they never returned. Ugala never saw them again. When she grew up, she went in search of them, but found hostility at the other islands, so she made a hasty retreat back to Warbler, only to find that her father, the king, had passed away in her absence, and she was the new ruler." Alex and the others listened, spellbound, amazed at Sky's natural ability as a storyteller, and her ability to speak so well after having been silenced for so long. He found himself admiring her even more. Sky continued, "Fearing that her siblings had been killed by hostile enemies, she worried for her people and commissioned the residents of Warbler to dig the tunnels and caves for their own protection, which they did willingly. Soon Warbler appeared to be completely uninhabited, and she added the silent spell over the island, not only so the Warblerians could work with concentration, but so no passerby would ever suspect. There was no noise from axes or hammers to be heard anywhere, and everyone was commanded to speak softly when outside. Queen Ugala credits herself for keeping Warbler from attack. But she wanted to be prepared for war, so she began to build a fleet of ships and sailing canoes." Sky looked around. There are over 100 ships hidden in the trees, and various stages of completion, she said. 100? Alex said, eyes wide, and then he frowned. How many people are there on Warbler anyway? It can't be more than a few hundred, can it? Sky looked at him solemnly. Thousands of people, all hidden underground. Most of them silenced like dust, from the age of 10, and the younger children are housed far below to keep their voices from being heard. It's like an ant colony. Everyone's scurrying around in silence, doing their jobs, going from one place to the next. Haluki spoke up. Did the people also agree to wear the thorn necklaces? He sounded incredulous. Sky shook her head. No. The thorns are recent from the last several years. People began to revolt against being forced to hide and whisper all the time. When other sailors found their boats drawn to the shores because of the strong current circling our island, Warblerians started sneaking away and emerging from hiding and to tell visitors of the restrictions and try to escape with them. So a Queen Agala found a way to silence the people completely, Alex said, wonder in his voice. How horrible. Sky lifted her chin high and didn't falter. What about the eyes? Claire asked from her bed in a weak voice. It's our brand, our mark that we belong to Warbler. In any case that we are discovered elsewhere, she said. This time her words were tinged with bitterness, and then she looked down. I guess the bird thing really was just to scare us, or they wouldn't have bothered to make our eyes orange. But I guess they'll come after us eventually, if they believe we survived our escape. And for that I am really sorry. If you don't want us to stay here... Claire pushed up on her elbow in alarm, and Alex stood up in protest. Of course you'll stay here, he said. You and Crow, too, help fix Artemae. I don't care what color your eyes are. You guys are Artemaeans now. Alex flushed. If you want to be, I mean. He sat back down, feeling like he probably just overreacted a bit in his haste to assure them that they had to stay. But the thought of them leaving now? He caught Claire and Gunnar exchanging smiles and glances, which made him flush even hotter than before. Sky flushed, too. Florence squelched an ebony smile and saved them by saying, They'll have to get past Simber and me first, but let's turn our thoughts back to Lonnie and Sam Heed and how we're going to find them in that maze. Right. Alex looked back at the map and studied it some more. Thousands of people hidden above and under the ground, he mused, rubbing his temples. And some of them act as guards, shooting sleep darts. Sky and Crow nodded. Alex frowned and shook his head. How could they possibly take on thousands of people and find the two they wanted at the same time? They need a whole army of Artemaeans. At most, Simber could carry 4 on his back. Clara's boat, which was now ready and waiting, could hold at most 15 normal-sized people. Florence would sink Clara's boat just by stepping into it. But Alex needed her. He needed anybody and everybody who wouldn't be harmed by sleep darts. Slowly, Alex lifted his head, and the frown washed away. He thought for a second more, tapping his fingers on his knee, and then he turned. Florence, he said slowly, as if the idea was still in the process of coming to him. Can you please clear the lawn and then round up all the statues? Every last one of them, from the library to the lounge and all through the mansion, and send them to the theater. He pushed his chair back up and stood, rolling the map into a tube. I'll meet you there shortly. But first, he said, a slow grin spreading across his face, we're going to need a bigger boat. More plans. As Florence headed outside to clear the lawn, Alex raced up the steps to the somewhat secret hallway, said the magic words, door number 1, and entered the Museum of Large. He went straight toward the pirate ship and studied it, walking all the way around it with his hands tracing the perimeter, feeling its solidness. It had come ashore one day, Mr. Dade said. There had been just 2 sailors aboard, both dead. As Alex remembered Mr. Dade's story, he recalled that the old mage had said the sailors wore strange things around their necks. You've been to Warbler before, haven't you? Alex murmured. Perhaps you're one of the ships from Queen Agala's fleet. The ship whispered and whispered. Alex strained his ears, but he couldn't understand it. Not even a word. Are you ready to have at it again? He asked. The ship seemed agreeable. I'll be right back. Alex strode out to the secret hallway and down to the end of it, to the window, and he looked out. The lawn, beach, and sea were cleared. Alex smiled. He went back to the museum and stood next to the pirate ship. He put his hands on the hole, closed his eyes, and pictured the sea in front of the mansion. He held the picture in his mind for a long moment, his hands quavering a bit, and trying not to think about what would happen if something went terribly wrong. And then, after a deep breath, he whispered, "Transport." The ship trembled for an instant, and then it disappeared. Alex opened his eyes, amazed at the huge space that now stood empty before him. He turned and ran back to the end of the hallway, and there, not quite all the way in the water, but pretty amazingly close, was the pirate ship. Phew! Alex breathed. He ran back to the museum, locked the door, and then tore back down through the tremending crowds of Artemans, who come inside the mansion at Florence's request. "You can all go back out and do whatever you are doing," he called out. "Just stay away from the ship for now, okay?" He dashed out the mansion's seaside door to make sure the ship was unharmed in its transportation process. As he reached the ship, he saw something in the sky coming toward him. He shielded his eyes and watched as Cimber, Megan, and Scene drew closer and landed on the lawn nearby. Alex ran up to them as Scene and Megan dismounted. "How did it go?" Alex asked. "Was it strange?" "A little," Megan said. She had a form of habit of touching the scars on her neck when she spoke. "But we were able to get in pretty close to see the tunnel that I escaped from, and we found a couple more spots where Cimber could sense people nearby, only we couldn't see them." She glanced at the ship. "Explain, please." Alex grinned. "We made some great progress today. You left this morning before I could tell you that Crow and Sky let me take their thornaments off late last night." He shook his head. "Sky gave us a ton of information. It's pretty scary over there, and this is going to be really difficult. Come on, I'm meeting with all the statues. I'll fill you in." Alex, Sean, and Megan went inside and made their way to the theater via tube, while Cimber went through the temporarily 3D door that Miss Octavia had put up for the larger statues. It was an odd assortment in the auditorium. Dozens of upon dozens of statues of all sizes had gathered, from the enormous Cimber in Florence, down to the tiny porcelain kitten in the size and color of a bite-sized marshmallow. The kitten perched on the shoulder of a somewhat rambunctious rust-colored fox statue carved from driftwood. The fox spent most of his time playing the saxophone in the lounge band. Charlie the Gargoyle was there, and even the tiki statue from the third floor library had somehow arrived despite having no legs to walk on. The grouchy ostrich that Alex and his friends had first thrown their origami dragon at was there as well, looking quite skeptical. Alex walked to the stage and stood next to the podium, facing them. He put his hands in his pockets and waited. When all was silent, Alex looked earnestly at the statues. "Thank you for coming," he said, putting his hands from his pockets and clasping them together in front of him. "Artemis is in great need of your help, and I'm wondering if any of you are up for a bit of an adventure." That evening, Alex gathered his most trusted instructors, friends, and mentors. He expanded the hospital wing slightly so they could all fit inside, and he met there for the sake of Miss Morning and Gunnar Haluki, who had now advanced to sitting up in bed. Alex held up a handful of papers, including the map of Warbler and the books about the islands that he had found but hadn't yet had a chance to read. He looked at Miss Morning and Gunnar first. "You know how to restore the world if anything should happen, correct?" he asked. "And you are physically able to do it if something bad should happen to me?" "Yes," Gunnar said solemnly. "Absolutely," Miss Morning said. Alex smiled. "Good. Here's a robe," he said, taking it off and handing it to Miss Morning. "You should wear it. If you don't have a robe and Artemis disappears, you're sunk." Miss Morning nodded and wrapped it around her shoulders, fastening it at her neck. Alex turned to Cimber. "Does anyone in Quill know that Artemis is restored?"
"Not to my knowledge, but I'm sure it won't be long before they do."
"And the Drynos?"
"They are ready for anything, and we have additional spies monitoring the road to Quill."
"Great." He looked down at Rufus, the Squirrelicorn, who stood next to him. "Do you have your team?"
"Ready and waiting, sir."
Alex smiled at the term. It felt strange to have a warrior like Rufus calling him sir, but he thought it was kind of nice and made him feel more confident about himself, so he didn't stop the creature from saying it. He looked at Megan, Sean, and Henry. "You guys good?" They all nodded.
"And you're sure you want to go?" Alex asked Henry. "You don't want to stay here with your dad?"
"I'm going," Henry said. "I need to rescue my sister, and I can help with the healing spells in case anybody gets hurt. I'm getting really good."
Alex nodded.
"I've noticed that."
"All right."
He turned to Sky and Crow. "Can you guys help keep things rolling around here while we're gone?" Sky's eyes narrowed. She glanced at Crow, whose face wore a look of surprise, and then she looked back at Alex.
"Oh," she said. "We thought we were coming with you."
Alex's lips parted, and then he glanced at Megan and Miss Morning to see their reactions.
"You'd be priceless in the way of helping, but I didn't think you'd want to," he stammered.
"What if they see you?"
She lifted her chin and folded her arms over her chest.
"Then the sight of me will be the last thing they ever see," she said.
Alex's heart swished, and he knew at that very moment that he wanted Sky on his side of any fight, any time, anywhere, for as long as he could convince her to stay in Artemis.
And finally, they're off.
Before dawn, Alex got up.
He loaded up his component vest and filled an extra sack with more components. There was no way he was going to run out, that was for sure. And with him in charge, well, he had responsibilities now.
"I'm going away," he announced to Clive. Clive, who was still miffed about finding out from other sources what happened to Artemy, didn't respond.
"We're going to try and rescue Sam Heat and Lonnie," Alex said. "They're captured on another island." He looked fondly at the growing line of prototypes of the components that he and his friends had been created, thinking he'd soon need another shelf to display them all. He glanced over his shoulder and said, "It could be dangerous." Clive pushed his silken face out of the blackboard.
"I guess I'll be the last to know if it is," he said. Then he sank back and disappeared.
Alex shook his head and sighed. It bothered him more than he cared to admit that Clive was still peeved at him. But he didn't know how else to explain the vast pressure that was on him. Or how much pressure had been on him the entire time that Clive and all the others were experiencing the magical equivalent to a visit to the Ancient Sector. He turned back to the components, double and triple checking his quantities, counting aloud to himself, not noticing that Clive had silently resurfaced again to watch him. Alex looked back at the line of prototypes. There was one Lonnie had made for the pincushion spell. Next to it was the tiny rubber ball Sammy had altered to look like a brain for the dementia spell. He wondered if he'd ever have any more of the creations lining the shelves. Alex smiled sadly as he recalled the day they'd sent their new spells soaring into their instructors. Had it really only been a few months since then? Alex felt like he'd become an entirely different person in that time. He reached up and took the pincushion and the tiny brain, creating them in his hand, admiring the fine detailed work his friends had done. He wondered if Lonnie had changed too, like he had. She must have, he thought. He couldn't begin to imagine what she'd gone through by now. Hard stuff forces you to grow up fast. That much he knew. But Lonnie was strong.
"I sure hope you're okay," he whispered. He felt a pang of guilt spear through him. With all Lonnie must be going through, he just couldn't stop feeling guilty about...
Well, he wasn't exactly sure why he felt so guilty about what he thought about her these days. Obviously because he hadn't rescued her and Sam yet, but that was hardly something he could help. Maybe it was because he didn't think about her as often as he used to. But, he argued with himself, stuff happens when your whole world disappears, and you have to count on the people who are actually there to help you make it through it. He squeezed his eyes shut for a moment and opened them again. He looked at the components in his hand, then slowly closed his fingers over them and put them in his pocket for good luck.
"We're going to find you," he said softly. "We just have to."
"And then everything will be back to normal," he told himself. Clive slipped away once again. Alex took a deep breath and let it out, then squared his shoulders, picked up his supplies, and carried them out to the door. He opened it, glancing at the blackboard, but only seeing words. "Bye," he said, and closed the door. He waited a beat, shrugged, and then headed out to the ship. Florence was already there, standing with an arm slung over the top of the lower deck. Beside her was a stack of crates, and she already had the gangway pulled out and resting on the ground. When she saw Alex, she nodded a greeting.
"I've had a look at this," she said. "I suggest we load the humans and the lighter folks. Then Sim and I will lift and push this thing out into deeper water. It'll go faster that way. I'm rather getting it into the water first than transporting the Artemians back and forth. I'll climb on and Sim wants to fly, which is good."
Alex felt a sense of relief wash through him. He'd been nervous, but he knew he had the best team he could possibly have.
"And someone here knows how to sail this thing, right?"
"Well, I could do it in a pinch," Florence said, adjusting her bulging quiver of arrows on her back. "But Siggy found someone else in the theater supply closet with a lot more experience. He's bringing him by the bit."
"Perfect," Alex said. "High tide is around 8. That'll help with launching this crazy ship."
"You know it whispers, right?" Florence asked. Alex nodded. "Any idea what it's saying?"
"No," Florence said. "Hopefully nothing bad." She smiled and picked up the stack of crates, lifting them over the railing and placing them on the deck. Before long, a strange assortment of volunteers had assembled in groups, according to their assigned leaders. Alex, Sean, Megan, Miss Octavia, Florence, Simber, and Rufus each carried a written list of their charges, each leader responsible for counting and keeping track of their volunteers. The statues mostly stood quietly, though a few hopped around sniffing things while the squirrelicorns circled overhead. Soon Mr. Appleblossom arrived, walking with a marble statue. He was a man with a peg leg and wore the uniform and hat of a scene captain. Mr. Appleblossom stopped in front of Alex.
"A bright and lucky morn to you, my boy," he said. "Meet Captain Ahab, here to run your ship. A finer man the sea has never known." He leaned in and whispered, "Take heed or find yourself with a fat lip."
Ox's eyes widened.
"Ah, nice to meet you, Captain Ahab."
"Pirates!" exploded the statue, pointing at the sails. "Blast my skull to bits!"
Alex stared. He slid his gaze to Mr. Appleblossom, who smiled politely, almost with mischief, and said nothing.
We're not pirates. We're just going to the island there and then back again. Can you sail this thing?"
"Ransacking thieves!" he roared. "You ever seen a white whale?"
He leaned toward Alex, leering at him. Alex fought off a strange urge to laugh. No wonder Mr. Appleblossom kept this statue in the props closet. The captain was crazy, and Mr. Appleblossom knew it. But he was a ship captain, and, well, they really needed him. Alex decided to try a more direct approach.
"Follow me," he said. He turned abruptly and started the gangplank, hoping the captain was following him.
A minute later, the uneven thump of the statue's gate assured Alex he was.
"When we push off, I need you to take us there," Alex said once they reached the main deck. He pointed to Warbler.
"Okay?" The captain peered out over the water.
"There she blows," he bellowed.
He pointed to what looked like Alex, like the island beyond Warbler, which they could see sometimes, and sometimes not, depending on the light and the waves.
Alex looked out to the sheer curiosity, and thought he saw a bit of froth rising from the surface of the water, but a second later, that was gone. He shrugged. Maybe this guy had a thing for whales, but that was probably just a big wave crashing against a rock wall.
"Great," Alex said. "Stay here and be ready."
"Ye blast my skull!" the captain said in return.
"You're blasting mine," Alex muttered, and then made a hasty retreat when he remembered what Mr. Appleblossom had said about avoiding a fat lip. A glance at the waterline on the sand told him that they were near high tide. It was time to go. He peered over the ship's rail and called out, "All aboard!" He watched the army, pleased as they boarded the ship in an orderly fashion. Those who could fly did so, and those who couldn't made their way to the stations on foot, the legless tiki statue again mysteriously appearing on the deck, without anyone having noticed it moving. When Mr. Appleblossom returned to the mansion to help run things, and everyone but Simba and Florence was on board, Simba braced his rippling shoulder against the stern and lifted up, taking care with the rudder. Florence gripped the sides, lifting and pushing. Together they poured all the weight into the dislodging the ship from the bit of sand that remained. Simba growled when the water lapped at his feet. He had enough of that lately. But he pushed on, and soon he and Florence were gliding through the water with ease.
"That's enough for me," he said to Florence,
and began to flap his wings, rising into the air. He shook his body to get rid of the awful liquid. Florence smiled and waved him off.
"Poor kitty," she said.
Simba growled again, this time playfully, and showered Florence with droplets.
"We're far enough," he said. "Grab hold, I'll give you a leg up."
"Everybody to the bow," Florence shouted. She let go of the ship and, careful to avoid Simba's wing, slung an arm around his neck. He rose slowly, bringing Florence up and out of the water, and set her gently on the deck opposite everyone else to keep the ship from capsizing. Captain Ahab gave a shout, and with that, they were seaborne. But then, just as they pulled away from their glorious Artemis, a figure burst from the mansion's seaside door and rushed to the shore, waving her arms and shouting, "Wait!"